silver star and a purple heart, two bronze stars, two French croix de guerre. My outfit was attached to the First French Army, so we fought under the French First Army, and we earned two croix de guerre, which is really pretty...
That's like their Medal of Honor.
Two. Yeah.
I never even see. I've heard the words of just my word.
Two.
And what are these from?
Do you know the significance?
Oh, they're the ribbons that they're the medals that go. I don't know what they are. That is for the European, and there's two little battle stars on there too. But that's for the European Rhineland area. I think that's a good conduct medal or something.
But you got this one from the French.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And tell me the name of this again.
Well, French croix de guerre.
Croix de guerre.
Croix de guerre, but they, I think they pronounce it croix de guerre.
Okay.
And then this was from the French army too.
Wow.
When it came, I didn't get.
And did you get that at the time that you?
No, they sent that to me later on.
And how much longer after?
Oh, golly.
I left and I said, okay, read through this.
40-50 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not too long.
I wondered.
And so anyhow.
Well, let me take, if I can, take a picture of you with your medals.
We went over twice, and it was really wonderful. We just really, and the first trip was part of, covered part of it. The second trip covered everything that the 63rd did, whether there were two guys involved or five or the whole unit. They would either take a taxi, take a van, or take three buses.
So they all stayed together. You got there individually, and then it was just like the olden days.
Well, we went over together too. We all flew over together.
They flew out of Florida, Boston, and Chicago on the second trip.
Was
the first
trip
we all went
about?
Out of New York. What?
A reunion you're talking about?
Yeah, a reunion in 1980. We went over in 1985 back over to Europe. And then again in 87.
And was 85 the first time you went back since the war?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
there was 50 of us went on that, counting our wives.
52.
And then in 87, there was 150 of us went.
Oh, wow.
We had a big time.
I really
enjoyed it.
Were any of those other people also Montanans?
No. I only know of about three people from Montana that was in our whole division out of 15,000 people. No more than that because there was some replacements.
Is that because you lived someplace else when you signed up?
Well,
I was from Montana.
Because there weren't very many people here.
Still aren't.
The people fortunately lived on the East Coast, and that's where the most of them are from. New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the biggest share of the bunch are from those areas.
Yeah.
And they still get together once a year. Huh. And last year was going to be the last time. We aren't going to go again last year. Well, 2 years ago. Then they were going to Washington, D.C. last year. So, well, they just put in the new memorial, so we couldn't miss that.
Sure.
So we went back to Washington, D.C. Well, then this year was down in Kansas City, and it was so close that we couldn't miss that. So,
so never say never.
Yeah, right.
Next year it's in Tacoma, Washington, so we'll have to go to that.
So anyhow.
But anyway, that's...
Well, let's go upstairs and
you took a picture.
I did, Greg.
We'll have to show you. Before you go, we'll have to show you our sat irons.
Yeah, you know anybody that has a sat iron collection?
No.
Well, if you run across somebody that wants to add to their sat iron collection, let us know.
And when did you start collecting these?
Oh, golly, I don't know. In my work, I'd get into old abandoned buildings and things like that. This was my great-great uncle, and he was General Custer's chief of scouts. He was a white man, as you can see, but quite a frontiersman, and he was Custer's chief of scouts. Was killed in the battle.
He was with Reno, wasn't he?
He was with Reno that day.
He was with
and
Reno that
name?
Day.
And Lonesome Charlie Reynolds. It was Charlie Reynolds. And
he's got a poem in here.
Oh,
about
okay.
In that. And
Anyhow, he's buried down by No.
Garyon.
He was
about a mile down in an alfalfa field. You can see stone from the highway if you know where.
Why there and not with
that's
the other?
That's where he fell.
That's where they found
so
his remains.
They didn't.
Reinter
him.
Yes.
Intentionally because he wasn't.
The remains are up in the big. In the big burial up at the under the monument.
But that's where he fell, and that was where it was marked. Hmm. And so it's still marked down there. And
there's an historian, I'm trying to remember his name. I know you will know him. I met him before, and he's written several books, slim volumes, and the last one, he calls me when he has one, Custer's Scouts. So it's about Custer's Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
A chapter on each.
Oh, is that right?
And he has a long historical connection to that area, and he's not a Native American, I don't think, but I'll remember his name, and when I get back, I'll make sure I have your contact area, because you should have that book,
and
because
there's
a
connection. I might have had it, but he was... We had a whole raft of books we sold to a guy up here at Three Forks. And,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, it tells in here about, this is all a poem, about the excursions that he had. He was with Gore, the guy that, not the vice president, but the guy that, the Englishman that came over and hunted all the buffalo and everything. And he led his expedition. He led scouted for the railroad when they brought the first survey crews in. Anyway, I finished it up. And these things that I've quoted in here, that I just put them in poetry from other writings. Lonesome Charlie was a legend, though quiet in his way. He ranked with the best frontiersmen, many were heard to say. He served his friends and country well. I'm proud of him, by golly. Besides his brave and daring deeds, he was my Uncle Charlie. But I forgot, here's what I was... Reynolds was with Major Scouts in that bloody expedition. Reno Scouts attacked from the south with heavy opposition. Major Reno pulled his troopers back in the thickest of the fray, but Dr. Porter needed help, so Reynolds decided to stay. He covered for the doctor, who escaped up through the draw, and when the burial crew arrived, this is what they saw. Charlie Reynolds, who was an expert shot, beside his horse was dead. He fired 60 cartridges before running out of lead. And that's where that tombstone is.
Did you say 63?
60 cartridges.
Hmm.
So they say.
Oh, hard man to kill.
And wonderful poetry.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he didn't get 60 shots. He fired 60
shots. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. By how you know.
No. It's still wonderful poetry.
Thank you.
No, I know he wasn't hit. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he defended himself for an awfully long time. So.
Yeah.
Anyhow,
well,
we
had fun with all of it.
We had. We ended up. That bookcase, this one right over here, and all of this, and that, and the bottom one there, and some more.
They're full now, but
we
they
just
were
disposed
full of Western
them.
Americana books.
Oh, anyhow.
So interesting.
There's a...
That was fun.
I showed them your saddle there, Nancy.
Yeah, beautiful saddle. Your saddle.
Yeah.
And then Bob likes to tell us he's not an artist.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, he had lots of fun doing those things. Yeah. Now, can I make you a cup of tea or coffee, or would you like some Coke or something? Iced tea?
No, I'm still just okay. How about you, Greg?
I'd like something to drink, whatever is most convenient.
Hot, cold, or?
Cold would be my
iced tea, or what?
A Coke, or I see either
I'll get
one.
I'll get
just fine.
This is an interview with Bob Ross and his wife Nancy, and my husband Greg is here and attending, and myself. And today is November 19th, 2005.
We talk too much. So.
Well, I have told my husband that a time or two. But what I'd like to start you, Bob, if we can, is if you would just give me a little background on your upbringing, your siblings, where you came from, and then we'll walk into World War II.
Well, I was, as I told you or showed you that picture, I was born and raised on a ranch about 15 miles south of Muscle Shell, Montana, back in the Bull Mountains, and went to school part of the time in a country school there and part of the time in Muscle Shell. When I was in the seventh grade, my brother Hal was in a freshman in high school. He and I botched about, this is another story. We botched in a little log cabin about a mile north of the town of Muscle Shell, right alongside the curve in the river. And an old ranch family friend by the name of Bill Jacobs, who had been an early day freighter, he came in and used to freight from Junction City, which is now Custer, over to the gold mines at Maiden up out of Lewistown. And then he settled and homesteaded there close to Muscle Shell. And my brother Hal and I batched in his little bunkhouse one winter of 1935 and 36. And then Hal and I went to school in Billings after that because we thought we could get part-time work, which we did. We set pins in a bowling alley. Oh. For the next 4 years, I set pins in the Babcock Bowling Alley.
Oh.
Where the Babcock Theater is now? Is that a bowling alley?
It's a Babcock building, I think, and there's a Babcock Theater.
Sure.
The Babcock Theater is around the corner from where it used to be. It used to be on Broadway on 28th. But anyway, and I graduated from high school in 1940. Went to work that summer with my dad in a logging camp up in the Snowy Mountains.
The first graduating
He had a logging camp. Pardon me?
The first graduating class in the new high school. The first graduating class in the new high school.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, and I worked with my dad for about 6 months, and then I had two brothers who were going to school up here at the college. And
in Montana State.
Yeah.
Richmond.
And my brother Jim and my brother Hal were both going to school up here. And Hal especially kept telling me I'm supposed to be up there going to school. And finally, I got a little letter from him about this logging camp, lumber camp, and it just says, come to Bozeman as soon as you can. That's all it said. Figured he was in some kind of trouble, so my dad had to take a load of lumber to Billings that day for the old Pierce Packing Company. And so I rode to Billings with him and caught this stage on up to Bozeman. And asked him what kind of trouble, he asked my brother what kind of trouble. He said, oh, nothing. He said, I've got a job for you. I said, what doing? He said, washing dishes. And I said, I've already got a job.
Oh, no.
And he says, yeah, but you'll get paid for this. You get 35 cents an hour for washing dishes. Anyway, I was ready to go back, but he talked me into staying. And that's how I got to college.
No.
Went 2 years before the war.
So you came to college here in Bozeman to go to Montana State University. What year did you begin?
That would have been January of 1941.
And
yeah.
And then went to school for the next
two
years.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't go to school. I just worked. I was washing dishes. for that spring quarter. But
and at the same time, you had two brothers who also were in college?
Yeah.
Now, today, that would be quite a financial burden on a parent. How were you able to do that at the same time?
Parents had nothing to do with it. We just worked.
Yeah.
So each of you did what you had to do to earn the money.
We put ourselves through college all the way.
All of you did.
And you had, there were four brothers?
There was seven kids in our family. I had, six boys and one girl.
Okay. And just opposite of my family. I have one brother and five sisters.
And my sister graduated from what is now Billings. It was a normal school.
Oh, sure. Rocky?
Yeah. And she graduated from that and then taught for 2 years or 3 years. And my two brothers and myself, we all graduated in agriculture up here. Well, I went to the war. All three of us boys went to the service right after 42. And then my brother Hal and I came back and finished up after the war.
So did you all three enlist at the same time?
No. No, my brother Jim was an officer. He was an officer's candidate school. And he went in about 6 months before my brother Hal. And my brother Hal went in about a year before I did. I had enlisted, this is kind of funny, a bunch of us in a fraternity house up here had enlisted one Sunday morning. We got the old colonel from the ROTC out of bed early one morning, so one Sunday morning to sign us up. And everybody went to the war except two of us, the rest of them. There was two guys, one guy from over by Great Falls, myself. We were never called up, whether our names were lost, I don't know what. And finally, I was so ashamed to be seen on a street. I finally wrote to, somebody told me to write to Fort Douglas, the Army post in Fort Douglas, Utah. About 3 weeks later, I was on the road.
May I ask you a question?
That's all it took, yeah.
How did that work? You talked about being called up. Did people sign up to enlist and then
we enlisted.
Contact you later?
We enlisted. Colonel He signed us into the Army that Sunday morning. And then we were, when I say called up, we were called to active duty. And the most of them didn't have to go till after that, after spring quarter. This was probably about March when it wasn't either. Anyway, it was a few months later that any of them were called to active duty, and I wasn't called to active duty for a year.
They couldn't call everybody at the same time because they didn't have enough training facilities.
Well, I suppose so. So
that's probably why it had to be in stages?
Yeah, I don't know why. I always figured my name got lost, but I don't know what happened.
But
anyway, it didn't take very long after I got to the right place.
You complained, right?
I complained.
And then they said, okay.
And I was never sorry for it.
And so where were you when you heard that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
My brother Hal and I were vacuuming the lounge up in the Student Union building up here at the college. We were both working up there. And it was Sunday morning. That's when we heard about it.
And so it was soon after that that your brother Hal...
He went into the airport very soon after that. Probably February, maybe.
Okay.
That was December the 7th.
He was older.
Yeah.
two years older.
And so then, once you were enlisted, what was the procedure then? Where did you go? And
went to Fort Lewis, Washington. I was inducted into Fort Lewis, Washington. That's where my orders read for me to report to. And there about a, excuse me for having to clear my throat all the time, can't help it. But there for about a week taking, getting the shots and uniforms and close order drill and all kinds of stuff, rigmarole. And one morning they called us out into formation and they read off a bunch of names. My name was amongst them. That these men have all volunteered. They enlisted in the Army and they get preference as to what branch of service to go into, of the, what branch of the Army. And the most of them wanted to get into the Air Force. I wanted to get into the cavalry because that's about all I knew, was horses and cowboy and ranch life. So I wanted to get into the cavalry. And the old sergeant that was interviewing me, he says, well, he says, the cavalry's about run its course. They don't have used too many cavalrymen anymore, except for horseshoers and trainers. And so real quick, I turned into a pretty good horseshoer. And told him how many horses I'd broke, which probably wasn't as many as I said. And oh, he says, I think you've got a pretty good chance of getting in the cavalry. 2 days later, I was on a troop train headed for Van Dorn, Mississippi with the infantry. And I was never satisfied. I mean, I was never sorry. I enjoyed the infantry.
And the chiggers.
No, I didn't like the Mississippi chiggers. They about ate me to death.
Those are bed bugs, right?
Yeah, they're like bed bugs.
Oh. And what was your training like? Did you get good training, or did you... I know Ben talks about that he pretty much, if he hadn't been a Montana boy, he'd gone out there, he wouldn't have known how to shoot a gun.
No, we got excellent training.
He did.
But this was, Ben went in a lot earlier than I did, and they were hurt, as his history shows that they were the, we'd lost the war up until then. And no, we had excellent training. We had outstanding officers.
And you're talking about Ben Steele?
Ben Steele,
right.
When he went in.
Right. And I think because it's being tape recorded, if the tape is going to be important, I think your connection to Ben Steele might have some importance on the tape.
Well, just Ben and Bob were both raised in the same area.
Yeah.
Grew up and knew each other.
Right. Actually, we didn't know one another at that time.
Oh, you didn't?
By the time I came along, they'd already moved to Billings. His dad was, I think old Ben was in the sheriff's department or something, I believe, in law enforcement somehow or another. Ben Sr.
Right.
No, I never knew Ben until 10 or 15 years ago when we met him down at the Yellowstone Trail of the Westerners.
But you grew up?
We grew
miles
up.
Miles apart.
Yeah, we're about 5 miles from one another.
And just met each other 15 years ago.
Yeah.
That was really...
Those were hard times back in those days.
In the 30s? Yeah.
But those hard times also made good soldiers.
Yeah, they did. Made you stronger. I know that's what that's what my dad said, and that's what Ben has said. Made all the difference. Funny, you look back at that time and when you're living through it and you think it's so horrible, but then you look back at it over your life period and you think, if I hadn't had that, I might have not been as strong when I was in the war.
Right.
And yet I think a lot of people do not, basically, you look back and it was tough and whatnot, but everybody was in the same boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't have a bunch of kids that had TVs and all the rest of this stuff that they do today, and somebody that doesn't have them.
Yeah.
Everybody was in tough shape.
The ranch kids, excuse me, the ranch kids and made some of the best soldiers, I thought anyway, because they knew how to take care of themselves, how to work, and do things on their own.
Okay.
And the tough street kids, the city street kids, were the same way. They made awful good soldiers because they could take care of themselves and knew how to fight.
So what was your parents' response with, at one time they had how many sons in the service? Four? Were all four of you in?
Yeah, there was four of us in the service. Three at the same time, and then later on my younger brother went in during the Korean War.
And did all four of you make it out?
Yeah.
And where were you all? Basically in the same area, in Europe?
No, I was the only one who went to Europe. My brother Jim and my brother Hal were both in the Pacific, down in the Guadalcanal and Australia and down in that country. And my younger brother was in the Korean War, but he didn't go overseas. He was stateside.
Okay. And so your two brothers, were they together or
no,
just in the same area?
No. One of them was in the Air Force.
Okay.
My brother Hal was in the Air Force. And my brother Jim was a major in the Army. He was in General MacArthur's headquarters unit.
So he was in the Philippines?
Yeah, he was in the Philippines.
Did he become a prisoner of war?
No, he would have been there in that time. I think he might have been a little further up and didn't get captured. Or a different type of
island?
Yeah, well, a different island or a different
situation
anyway.
And so did you request Europe, or were you just...
No.
Okay.
Doesn't do much good to request. I found out.
Oh, you know, but my father requested the Philippines.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
That was before Pearl Harbor.
That would have been, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I just didn't know what...
That would have been pretty good service over there.
Well, that's why he requested.
That's what he figured.
Yeah, all the little Hawaiian gals.
He talked about
the beaches.
Also.
He never said that part.
No, he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. He never said that. Yeah.
You must have known him.
No, he never said that part. So tell me then, how, once you got to Europe, where did you...
It took me a long time to get to Europe. We were, it was an infantry outfit that I went to the 63rd Infantry Division. And I didn't, like Nancy mentioned a while ago, I didn't care for the, it was so beastly hot and humid in Mississippi. Cold in the wintertime, I about froze to death. Never got cold enough to freeze water, but I was cold, just penetrating. And my real good buddy, John Brandt, he and I tried to get into the paratroopers and the ski troops and several other places, but they wouldn't release us because we were a cadre for training. We were training men for battle in the infantry, and we trained two separate divisions of men that shipped out ahead of us. And then as the third, in our third group, we all went over together.
So when you were done with your training, they made you an instructor and wouldn't let you go off,
yeah,
because they wanted you,
right,
to keep teaching other people how,
yeah,
to be soldiers.
Right. I was, I'd had 2 years of ROTC training up here, which, and my old Army real good buddy from Illinois went in the same time I did, and same platoon entered up, and he had 2 years of ROTC training also. And that gave us, John and I, just a step ahead of 90% of the other fellows. At least we knew which foot was which and how to carry a rifle and things like that. So we started getting promotion.
Because of the ROTC training and experience, were you offered a chance to become an officer?
Yeah,
you...
both of us were. And John would have been a better candidate than I would. I didn't tell him that. No, neither one of us did. Neither one of us went to... I didn't go because I was young and immature, and I just didn't feel like I was officer material. Really, really and truly, that's the way I felt.
How old were you at that time? When you first enlisted, when you were first inducted?
I was older than most of the average inductee. I was, I guess I was 20 years old when I went to the service. Most kids went in 17 or 18 or drafted at 18.
Do you think being older helped you through the war, helped you to survive?
Well, I suppose it could have. I think mostly, I say because of my ranching background and depression years, of course all of them had just come out of depression too, but just being able to work and think for yourself and to scrounge for yourself, look after your buddies.
When you talked about your friend,
John.
You only met him when you got to.
When we got to Camp Van Dorn the first day, into the same platoon, and we were, until I got wounded, we were together all the time.
And so when you were wounded, I don't want to jump ahead. So I'm sorry. So I'll just let you continue on.
To where?
from the camp. Okay, yeah.
Well, we finally went over. The whole division went over together.
When was that?
In
43?
September of 44.
Okay.
September of 44.
A few months after the Normandy invasion.
Yeah, we were fortunate. We missed the Normandy invasion. We missed the Marseille. We went in through Marseille, France, southern France, but we were just a week or two behind the invasion of Marseille, too. I was lucky to everything I did.
So you hit the land at Marseille in September of 44.
Yeah.
Where were the Allies at that time in France? Were had they reached Paris yet?
Oh, let me think.
There's still heavy fighting in France, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was still heavy. I don't know. I was never in. Well, I was in Paris on the way home, but and you know, an infantryman's war is where he is right there that day in that foxhole. That's all you knew.
Right.
But and I don't recall just how the dates go about, but all of eastern France, I fought all through. My outfit fought all through the northeastern France in what was called the Colmar Pocket. And it was, the Colmar Pocket was similar to the Bulge, except didn't get the publicity
Is that the Alsace region?
In the Alsace region, right. Mountain and vineyards and farmland.
So when you got to France, Marseille, then what happened?
They loaded us on old 40 and 8 box cars. These 40 and 8 box cars were holdover from the First World War. They got their name because they, in the First World War, they were used to haul 40 men or 8 horses, 40 and 8. Oh. And there was, and one platoon constituted just in the army, in the American army, one platoon was just about 40 men, so we were packed into one little old box car that wasn't as big as this living room or this dining room here. And I've got a poem in that, in one of those books about the 40 and 8 box, riding the 40 and 8 box cars. But anyway, we spent 5 days in that going up, and the bridges, many of the bridges, railroad bridges, had been blown and then repaired and blown and repaired. So anytime they stopped, came to a gully, somebody had to get out, they had crews that got out and walked across to make sure that it was all right. And that little engineer, but I could still hear that sharp little toot toot. And off we'd go again. And 5 days and five nights we were on that thing. Colder than a dickens. And anyway, that was an experience in itself.
So for 5 days, five nights, you traveled in the, on these trains, it's 48 boxcars.
Yeah, until we got up into almost to the Rhine River in the northeastern France. And then we were housed, we spent Christmas in an old Napoleonic horse cavalry stables. Spent Christmas in those stables. And cobblestone floors, cold, awful cold. That winter of 44 and 45 was the coldest that Europe has ever had on record. And we were, except for those couple of nights in that stable, we were slept out most of the time. That was the worst part of the war, was the cold.
And what time of year was it that you're talking about that you were there? Right, at that
well,
point
when, the time we got up there to, in that old Napoleonic stable, it was September, about the 1st of October probably,
okay.
44. But cold, we had a lot of snow too. And from then on, why, we fought our way down south again. I've never quite figured out why we had to go north to fight our way south, but that's the way the battle was. And then turn around and fought our way back north again.
And once you got off the train, you became infantry, and everything, all your movement was on foot?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what was that fighting like in those first days? You had no combat experience at that time, right?
Not really.
Any of the guys, were there many guys with you who had any combat experience?
No, we were all trained together in Mississippi. And I'm sure that our higher ups were. And when we got over there and hit the Alsace-Lorraine country, they split our division up. A division is made up of three regiments. And they split our regiments up. My regiment, well, two of our regiments went to the 3rd Division. I was in our basic division was the 63rd, but we went to the 3rd Division. They're the ones that first went into Iraq with the Marines. I mean, the Marines went in the Army 3rd Division, got the little blue and white square stripes on their hat, on their helmet.
Was that also the Patton's division? The
No, Patton was the 5th Army, I think.
Okay.
And and he was with tanks. But of course he had infantry with him too. No, we were not with Patton. Actually, I was with the 7th Army for a while. And then somewhere along the line, when we were taken out of the 7th Army, and attached to the 1st French Army.
Is that unusual? You were U.S. soldiers at
Trenton. U.S. soldiers fed on it.
And who gave the orders? Frenchmen?
Well, General Lazigne Sagniette or something like that. I forgot what his name was, but he was the overall general. And then he had the divisions. He was the army general, and then he had corps, and I guess he had divisions under him. And my regiment, and the regiments under the division, my regiment was attached to the 3rd Division.
Is that unusual in that war for American troops such as you to be attached to a French force?
I can't answer that. I don't know. I don't know. There's a lot of politics play in war just like they are in present day.
Yeah.
Were there any communication problems because of the language, French and English?
Oh, we fought right alongside the French soldiers, and you communicate like a dog or a horse does, I guess. You know what you're supposed to do, and they did too. Yeah, we could communicate to a degree.
And so how long did you fight side by side with the French soldiers?
Well, when you say side by side, we were attached to them, so we didn't associate with them too much. We did especially in a little town named Jibsheim, which was a terrible, terrible battle. We fought over that little old village, which wasn't as big as
Belgrade.
Wasn't as big as Belgrade, as big as Fromberg, maybe, or Bridger.
Why was it significant?
The Germans had a corps headquarters there, we found out later on. After we finally took the town, we found out that it was a German corps headquarters.
And that's why it was a target?
Yeah, that's why we had, and we were, my regiment, my 254th regiment, was kind of, we found out later on, was thrown in there as a kind of a buffer. We were just supposed to soften it up, and if they lost the whole regiment, why, that's,
so you were
right
the,
us off.
Instead, we took the town
and liberated it.
And it's winter, or it's cold, snowy winter conditions?
Oh, terrible.
And what was the terrain like?
What was what?
The terrain, the land.
Oh, mountains. And the Germans, when we went back over, like I said a while ago, all you know is where you are that day, that night, what foxhole you're in. You don't know what's going on, you know. And but when we went back over in 1985 and again in 87, retraced those steps, I don't know how we ever were able to win that battle, win any of it. Because the Germans had every high spot, had their 88-millimeter artillery guns, their big artillery guns, and landmines out, splattered in the snow, you know, and they could shoot at a mouse. They were so well covered. The only way that we ever able to take any of those battles was because we fought at night and just sheer guts. There wasn't a whole lot of strategy to it, I don't think. Well, that was strategy, just.
How long did that battle last?
For that one town, it was 5 days and 5 nights.
How many people were engaged? How many?
We figured, and in that little book you can read about it, but that I wrote, there's about 500 Germans killed. How many wounded, I don't know. And probably we lost 250 men killed out of our unit, plus another 200 wounded, probably.
So even though the Germans were entrenched, fortified positions, great big guns, landmines, high ground, you fought them man for man, and you didn't have any more casualties than they had.
We didn't have as many.
That's incredible. Why?
I don't know. I don't know. But and then that was probably our worst, our bloodiest battle. And the town of Jibsheim, which was, like I say, a corps headquarters. And then there was a high hill. We knew it as Hill 216, which was just a little ways before we got to Jibsheim, a high, just a hill. And it's covered with vineyards now. It's steep, but covered with vineyards when I went back. But it was all, we had to, take that hill too. It was about probably 1,200 feet elevation above the rest of the surrounding area. And we had, we just had, and again, we were thrown into that to soften it up. We weren't expected to take it. We did.
Wow. How long?
But we lost a lot of men on that hill, too.
How long did that take?
One day and one night. We started out about 7 o'clock in the morning, just before daybreak. And next morning we had it pretty well under control.
Bob, was that before you went into the town you're talking about, or was that after you? So that was before you went
before
to the town?
Before Gypsheim.
And so you were wounded, but was it in that time period that you were wounded? Or?
I was wounded just about the last hour, the last day of that Battle of Gypsheim. We fought, and it was house to house, room to room. And we'd take a house and thought we had it cleared out. 2 hours later, the Germans would have infiltrated back in, and we had to fight our way back, just back and forth, for 5 days and five nights, bloody. And anyway, and like I said, it was a Corps headquarters, so they didn't want, they had the orders to fight to the very last man. They were not to let that stronghold be defeated. And and the last big pillbox we finally took, and it was just about, it was on the 29th of January, and about 4:30 in the evening or 5 o'clock, just getting dark, pretty dark, just getting dark when the Germans started surrendering. They started coming out of the bunkers, 2 and 3, and then 5, 10, 15, 20, and we were just inundated with German soldiers trying to surrender. They knew that they couldn't last, and they figured they'd surrender and get out of it. And we had a stockade set up about a half a mile back behind our lines. And we were taking these prisoners as fast as we could. We wanted to get it done before total darkness. And as soon as the Germans started surrendering, the German artillery started pouring, just started pouring 88 shells in. And 88 shell is about so big around, so tall.
Onto their own men?
On their own men for surrendering. These were Hitler's hardcore. They were the old mainstays that troopers that was their life. Anyway, when they started surrendering, they started pouring shells in them. We still had to, we had no protection. We just had to try to strip them of their shell or their weapons. And prior to that, 3 or 4 hours before that, I had emptied a machine gun nest out that had four German captains in it. Each one of them had a P-38 pistol on them, and which was a pretty covered souvenir of a 38 pistol. Nice trim little pistol. Even the Germans thought it was, you didn't get those unless you were pretty high up.
Those were less, there were fewer of those P-38 Walters than there were of the Lugers, right?
Yeah, I think so. And a trimmer, I don't know much about the Lugers or the P-38s either, really. But the P-38 was really a covered. If you could get a P-38, you really had a nice souvenir.
So
I got four of those babies. I had four of them off the four captains. And so, and responsibility. We were already carrying everything we owned, and there I am with these four pistols buckled on me, loaded down with everything else. So I immediately gave two of them to a couple of other guys in our platoon that I ran into. And you got to, this whole thing is a state of confusion. Everybody's on his own and doing the best he could, and nobody in command. It's just every man for himself and doing what you thought was right. And so I gave two of them away, and I wanted to give another to this real good buddy, this John Brandt. And so I ran into my platoon sergeant, and I said, "John, have you seen John Brandt?" "Yeah," he said, "he just took a bunch of prisoners back to the stockade. If you take this bunch here," and they were lining a bunch, probably 35 or 40 prisoners, lining them up in this little old street that wasn't any wider than this, between the houses, between this room here, just a dirt street, stone houses on either side, been bombed out, and snow about a foot deep, colder than hell. He says, "You take this bunch of prisoners back," and he said, "you'll probably run into Brandt." So there was another guy and I, GI, American GI, we started back with these prisoners, and I'm kind of off to the right side. The other kid is kind of in the lead of them, and we're running them down the street on a run, and when an 88 shell hit right in the middle of them, right in the middle of these prisoners, and everybody just scattered. And I thought, my God, they're going to get away from us. But not so. It was the only, as soon as they found out there was only one shell coming in, the German soldiers right back in formation. Down the street they went. And the other GI, he was all right too. He had, I'm laying in the snow, can't get up.
Where were you hit?
I was hit in the neck. But I didn't know it. I didn't know I'd been hit. My arm wouldn't work, and my rifle got knocked in the snow, and I don't know how long I on my hands and knees trying to get up, and finally did. His arm wouldn't work.
So but had the POWs that you were taking, had they already...
Yeah, they right back into formation on their own, and down the street they went, and the other GI that was with them. He led them.
They didn't know you were back there.
No, or if they did, they couldn't do anything about it. And there was a whole bunch of GI or German soldiers that were laying there. Some of them dead, some of them wounded. I don't know how many, but several. And I suppose there was 35 or 40 and a whole bunch to begin with. And anyway, when I finally regained my senses enough, and I thought, going back just a little bit, I'd seen our platoon runner earlier in the afternoon had been hit by concussion. There was a 88 shell hit at the eave of the house just as he was going into our command post, and it knocked him, just a concussion, knocked him through that room and across, and laid him up against the wall, and I saw him an hour or two later, and he was still just laying there gasping for air, trying to, and I didn't think he'd ever die or ever live. He actually did later on when we knew him and we saw him. But years
that's
after.
Powerful shells.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a powerful shell and just a concussion, and I thought, because I didn't feel like I'd been hit. I didn't even give it a thought, I don't think, because I didn't feel of it. Didn't feel it. But I thought it was concussion was what the problem was.
So how long did you lay there in the snow?
Oh, I don't know. But I'd say 2, 3, 4 minutes maybe. And finally got up, picked my rifle up. And nothing I could do to help those guys. So we had a aid station about a block and a half from there, so I went back to see if I could get them help, get somebody to help those guys, the wounded.
Did you realize that you were wounded?
No, I didn't know it. I didn't know it till I got back to that command or to aid station and Sergeant Onko told him he better get down there and take care of those wounded Germans. And he said, well, he said, I better take care of your neck first. You're bleeding pretty bad. And I didn't, up until then, I didn't even know. I got a chunk of shrapnel about the, oh, a little bigger than a quarter, and almost a quarter of an inch thick, real jagged, had gone into my neck. Found out later, it apparently went in, not flat, but perpendicular, and, because that's the way the scar shows, and fractured my vertebrae, and veered off of that down through my neck and lacerated and lodged in my esophagus. And so that's what happened, but I didn't know it. I didn't know at the time.
So it hit a vertebrae, but it didn't hit the spinal cord?
Didn't hit the spinal cord, but it fractured the... Fractured
half an inch, and yeah, it would be tough.
Or if it had been, if it had gone in flat like that instead of like that, it had been all over it. And it lodged down my esophagus. I could feel, I couldn't swallow very good. I could get air, but I couldn't swallow very good.
And missed your carotid artery too, right?
Yeah.
Didn't get any major blood
there. It shattered the, there's a brachial plexus that runs the nerves down your side. And for about a year or two, I was pretty well paralyzed on my left side. But
not
finally,
just the arm. The entire whole, not just your left.
Yeah,
arm,
down into my down into my leg
because of the nerve. Damage.
Yeah, because of the nerve, there's fractured nerve centers up there. And anyway, it was about. Anyway, this medic says, "I better take care of you. You're bleeding pretty bad." He put a bandage on me and put some sulfanilamide on it. That's the only thing we had for infection, and he says, why don't you just lay down and take a nap? So I slumped over in the corner and I needed a nap. We hadn't slept for days or eaten for days either, as far as that goes. We were on the go.
And that was what day?
That was the 29th of January.
So, and you started fighting about October 1?
Oh. Yeah, in early
about
part
four
of October.
Months.
Yeah.
Day after day after
yeah.
day. When I have a question, you said that you got these officers in this, these four captains in this machine gun nest, and you got all the pistols. I'm guessing you took that by yourself?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm also guessing you probably got a medal for that. That's sensational.
I don't know. I never knew anything about that medal until a long time afterward. I think that was a different, I think that Silver Star, I think that was, nobody knew anything about those four captains, I don't think. That, what I got that Silver Star for was a different deal. Another sergeant and I, took a different, it was a different...
Before or after you were wounded?
Oh, before.
Oh, tell us nothing.
Yeah, before.
What happened there?
Well, these emplacements that the Germans, these were huge, big concrete pillar or concrete abutments, and some of them were two and three rooms down underground. So they might have 40 or 50 men to one of these bunkers. And we never knew, you know, all you had was a little old aperture that you're trying to throw grenades into or to fire into. And anyway, that...
Stairwell or something?
Pardon me?
Staircase in there that went down?
Yeah.
So deep?
Staircases. And,
uh-huh.
And we never knew it until... I'd never end one until we went back over and saw them in the Siegfried line and the Maginot line when we went back in 85 and 87. I was never in one before. that we'd try to throw grenades through that aperture, and you had, first of all, you had to get up close enough to where you could do that, you know. And it didn't, and there was, those bunkers were 3 and 4 or 5 feet thick concrete reinforced with rebar. So it was virtually impossible to penetrate them. And
those were underneath the city?
Yeah, they're down underground. Yeah. Yeah. We had no idea there. When the Germans started surrendering out of these 2 or 3 last bunkers, we couldn't imagine so many people coming out of them, but later on we found out that they were regular, almost hotels.
So what happened in this combat thing where you got...
Well, this other sergeant and I, we had a bazooka with us, and we fired a bazooka and we got a lucky shot through that aperture and captured, I don't know how many we got out of there. Most of them were dead. We didn't get them out. But I think that little write-up down on that board down there says 15, there were 15 of them killed in that one bunker. But Lord only knows how many more there were in there, I don't know.
They were firing at you, and you kept advancing to get close enough to try to take them out.
Yeah.
And
it was, they were just as confused as we were, probably the Germans.
When you said about the Silver Star and the write-up about why it was awarded, you showed us the display of your medals, and there are a lot of them, and one of them is the, and I probably mispronounced it, the Croix de Guerre.
Croix de Guerre.
And you said you received 2 of those.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, please.
Okay. One of them we got for liberating Jebsheim, the town of Jebsheim, and the other one we got for liberating the Colmar Pocket, the whole northeastern, that Alsace-Lorraine area.
And that's one of, or the highest military honor in France, right?
Well, I don't
know.
It wouldn't be the highest one. It wouldn't be like our Medal of Honor, like one of our highest medals in the U.S. But but the whole division, I just didn't get that. Our whole regiment, not the division, but our regiment got that for liberating Jebsheim and for liberating the Colmar Pocket. We got that award for those 2 battles.
You're hit, and he says, I think you need a nap. You said, I sure did. What happened after that?
I woke up a couple hours later, and Sergeant Onko wasn't there. Nobody else was there. He was the only one, only medic. And I got up, and one of my P-38s was gone. I had 2 of them, because remember, I was going to give one of them to John Brown. I never saw Brown. But I had 2 of them on me when I went in there. But I don't know, Onko, I'm sure, cabbaged onto one of them. I still had one of them. So I made it back to, I walked over to the command post. I was on my feet, and walked over to the company command post, and...
Which was how far away?
I don't know, I suppose 2 or 3 city blocks.
And you're by yourself?
Yeah, dark, very dark, no lights. And anyway, they laid me down on a stretcher, told me there was an ambulance coming. I was supposed to wait till the ambulance came. And so I figured, well, if the medic took one of my P-38s, the next medic's going to take the other. So I gave them to, I gave my, the one that I had remaining, I gave it to, I don't know, probably our lieutenant, platoon officer, I expect. I don't know who I gave it to. I gave it to one of them anyway, to be sure to give it to Brant, which he did. Brant still has it.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, one way or another, you got the gun to him.
Yeah.
In a roundabout way.
Got that one home.
Yeah.
But did your, what happened because of the wound? Were you able to continue to fight?
Well,
can I just ask one question before you answer that? When you talked earlier about you would clear out the houses and you thought they were cleared out and then you...
They'd infiltrate back right behind us. I don't know where they came from.
Oh, I wondered if they were coming from the bunkers at that point.
I don't know where they were coming from, but they were just like kicking an ant pile. You'd get them out of one hole and they'd come right back in.
Okay.
I don't know where they came from. It was confusion. There was no battle strategy to it. It was just man for man.
Okay. I'm sorry. No.
It wasn't quite that unorganized, but
and their
almost.
Their troops at this command center not only were fighting to the death, but they were their seasoned troops. They were...
Oh, yeah. These were the SS. They were some of Hitler's best SS troops. You bet they were seasoned. And and they knew the terrain, and they were living in virtually
bunkers.
Fairly warm, and had food too. We didn't have very much to eat either, because he couldn't carry it, and that's the only way you could eat was to what you had on you. But for that particular battle, anyway, and I'm not saying that for the whole thing because we had good rations when they could get it to us, but just couldn't get it to us there. And what was he going to...
After
I got back to the command post and I was laying there on a stretcher and I didn't know too much. I was in and out of it pretty much. And finally an ambulance came and picked some of us up, and I don't know how many were in that ambulance, or a couple of guys on stretchers and some of us sitting up on benches alongside. And it was probably 8 o'clock in the morning before we got back to what we call a MASH unit. And those MASH units are just exactly like they show on TV. They're busy people, I'll tell you, when it comes time to operate, whether they... And I got back to that. I woke up enough to unload from the ambulance and came to enough in the operating room. And as I recall, there was... When I was laying on the stretcher waiting to get operated on, there was three rows of stretchers, and I don't know, maybe four or five stretchers to a row.
All waiting for their
surgery, yeah.
And did they do the surgery right there, or did they move you into another room?
Oh, no, they did it right there. And it might be... I don't know. I think it was a schoolhouse where they were set up. I found out later, and I was out of it for several days, and I was in that MASH unit for about 4 days. And usually, it was only about 24 hours. You were shipped on to another hospital or back to the front, whichever. And
and you were there for 4 days because you were in that serious condition, or
some fighting going on?
That's because they just couldn't move you, or what was it?
Well, it was too precarious to move me.
Oh, okay.
I think because of the nature of the wound there in your neck, and probably all kinds of bacteria, and it was 10 or 12 hours before they ever got to us, you know, to the surgery. And then they took that shrapnel out down here. It went in back here, but they took it out here.
Did you ever know who the surgeon was who did this?
I wish I did.
You must have been awfully lucky to get a very special surgeon.
They were all good.
He still has some scar tissue in there. And he's had scar tissue removed from that area, from the back of his neck. And the doctor in Billings said the next time they would remove it from his neck. And he figured he was just lucky enough to get it removed. He wasn't about to face any more surgery. So. Mm-hmm. And that was just a couple of years ago that they removed the scar tissue from the back of his neck.
Was that causing you problems? The scar tissue, is that why you had that removed?
Yeah. Or? Oddly enough, it was this arm, though, I just excruciating pain in this arm.
In your right arm, but the
shrapnel right
on the left side.
The other paralysis and so on was in my left side. But, and about 50 years later was when it hit this arm.
Yeah. Pressure on the nerve.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just on the other side.
Right. And I didn't connect it with that at all. I mean, when this arm, I didn't know what was making it hurt. But when I got down to Billings and they got in there, when that's what he said, it was scar tissue from that wound.
So you have the operation, and you're out of it for a few days, and then what happened?
Well, I was in there for, I think, probably 4 days. And really about the only thing I knew was, well, for the first 2 or 3 days, they gave me a blood transfusion one night. I woke up enough to know they were trying to give me a blood transfusion. They couldn't find a vein. People have trouble even now finding a vein in me. And all I had to go use was a flashlight, and it looked like it was pretty dim to me. Anyway, I got a blood transfusion, and apparently that brought me back out of it. After the fourth day, they loaded me back up into an ambulance with other patients. And I think I spent a night in the town of Nancy, France. And then the next night, spent 2 nights in Paris. And
in hospitals or medical facilities?
Well, I don't know what it was in Nancy. I don't even remember that enough. But when we got to Paris, the hospital there was a converted. They carried me up 4 flights up converted hotel into a hospital. No elevators. They had to carry up the stairs. And I told the guys, I said, I was on a stretcher. He says, I can walk up here. There's no need of you guys. I can hold my head up by hanging on to my hair. And that's what I would do. I could go to the bathroom and run if I held my head up by hanging on to my hair. And I said, you stay on that stretcher. He said, we'll get you up there. Well, in the process, they scraped my medical records. Were in a little manila envelope wired to the handle of the stretcher. And in the process of carrying me up, that the medical records got scraped off. So I was didn't have any medical records at all. And in that little sack was my coveted piece of shrapnel that they'd taken out of me.
So you never got that?
I never got that, but I had it for a while.
How long were you there?
Well, I was only in Paris. I think I spent 2 nights in Paris. And then they sent me down to Cherbourg by ambulance. And I was in a tent hospital in Cherbourg for 30 days.
Oh, where's Cherbourg?
Cherbourg, France, on the east coast of France. It's north of the big invasion area. And I was there for a month, and then from there, and why? Originally, when I left the MASH unit, I was supposed to go BZI'd back to the Zone of Interior, back to America. But because they didn't have any records, why, I was kind of a lost ship. And anyway, after 30 days in Cherbourg, and then I spent another 30 days in a hospital in southern France.
England.
What did I say, France? In southern England. A month in southern England.
You could communicate during this time, so...
Oh, yeah, I could communicate.
They knew who you were, and you could talk to them. And
oh, yeah, I could communicate. I was never to the point, except when I was just at my very worst. I could always talk. But it's kind of funny, when I was in that MASH unit, about the fourth day, and I was able to, and I'd get up and go to the restroom, hanging onto my head, anyway, there was, and I hadn't eaten, I'm sure I hadn't eaten anything for at least a week. There was a can of apple butter and GI biscuits. They were real hard biscuits, we called them dog biscuits, but they were a real hard cracker. And I tied into those and I ate those crackers and apple butter. I don't know how many I ate, but several of them. I made a meal out of them. And that night, this old major that had done the surgery on me, he came in and he gave the ward people hell for letting me eat anything hard and anything except liquids.
For what reason?
Because of the lacerations in my esophagus.
Well, when you were eating, did you feel that?
Oh, I could feel it, but I was hungry.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really had to chew her up fine to get it, to be able to swallow it.
So did you go from the hospital in England back to the States?
Yeah, I went back to the States on a ship, and a Liberty ship, and was in New York for a day or two, and then they shipped me to California, Modesto, California.
Why all the way to California?
Well, my mother was living in California.
Oh.
And they sent me to the closest to Kim.
The closest, the hospital to where she was living. And when the three boys went overseas, she moved to California, to Hollywood, to be close to her daughter down there. So that was her home address then, was California. He was stationed there he was on medical leave for, I think it was something like 8 or 10 months. After they kept him in the hospital and then they released him temporarily. So he had to report.
Even in Modesto they kept him in the hospital.
Yeah, and then he had to report back to Modesto once a month because they had not released him as yet, because it had not healed completely. So he would have to report back to Modesto once a month, and then they'd give him another 30 days of leave, on medical leave, and then he had to report back. And so it was over a year or more before they released him and gave him a discharge. And so that was an experience also. And the thing, you've never been to Europe, have you?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, have you ever seen the bunkers? No. Any of the bunkers? What was the other one that the Germans built for the French to protect them from the Germans?
Maginot Line.
They could have 1,000 men underground for 1 year and feed them in the whole bit. They had a mortuary, they had a surgery, they had, you name it, they had everything a town had. All underground, a railroad.
A spring in there for water, fresh water.
And everything that was needed was all in that underground facility.
And where was this?
This is along the border of France, between France and Germany.
Yeah.
Built after the end of World War I by German, probably money, and German troops.
German engineers.
Right, because the Germans lost in World War I.
Yeah.
And it was built to benefit France and keep France safe from a German invasion. World War II comes, and the Germans, being pretty clever people, they decide, well, let's do what we did before. Let's go through our friends in Holland. And they went around the Maginot Line, and these permanent gun emplacements that were supposed to protect France didn't help at all. And the sad irony, of course, is...
See, this is the Rhine River.
The Germans get in without worrying about
it. I guess they run this way.
American troops, and had to fight the Germans,
France,
hiding in the same place.
And the Germans had built the Siegfried Line, which was a tremendously heavy bunker
and
fortifications.
I mean,
the French
did
the Maginot Line.
The tons of concrete.
When the Germans came through and overtook France, why they had both those bunkers.
Interesting.
And it was amazing how the, of course, there's a lot of different units claim they were the first ones to infiltrate the Siegfried Line, including some of my boys, some of my friends. I wasn't with them at that time, but they claimed that they were the first ones to penetrate the Siegfried Line. But we were back over there, and those bunkers were just tremendous. 4 or 5 foot thick reinforced concrete, and no way you could blow them up.
So do they still exist?
Yes.
You bet they still exist.
Yeah.
Well, some of them do. Some of them, just a lot of those fortifications, when we were back there in 87, they could move into those.
Jeff Scheim.
They could move into those same bunkers tomorrow.
Jeff Scheim actually has used it for the main entrance to the Corps headquarters there. They've used it kind of as a garbage collection facility because there was no way they could destroy it because of the concrete. And so they had a lot of brush and a lot of debris dumped into those. But it wouldn't take much to burn it out and clean it out and whatnot. And the cannons and whatnot that were still in the top of the castles up on top of the mountains, they had just removed the mechanism for shooting them, but they were all still in place up there in those
In the top of one castle by Schwabisch Hall in southern Germany when we went back over. And how many big old cannons were there? Seven maybe, something like that?
So.
Six or seven or eight cannons up there.
Posted at each window, or one at each window.
Jeff, all you got to do is put the firing pins in. And
Jeff Scheim was on this Maginot Line.
Yes.
It was intended to be installation to protect France, and it was used effectively to protect Germans.
That's right.
From you.
Yeah.
Oh. Now I can understand why it was so hard to take.
Yeah.
That's important to know.
Yeah. There's this Hill 216. And all this country is kind of plains country. this whole thing is a coal marsh pocket. That this, for several miles around, this Hill 216 was just like you could just look, you could shoot a mouse 3 miles away if you could shoot that good.
And Strasburg is the heart of Alsace-Lorraine.
Yeah. And there's this little town of Gibbshine that's right there.
So after you came back stateside, you ended up in the hospital at Modesto because that's where
it was
your mother were close to.
Well, yeah,
living.
And it was a neurological hospital.
So it was a special hospital to deal with the nerve damage
right.
that you had.
Yeah.
When you said you had paralysis on your left side, were you not able to walk? Or
I could walk.
Did you have a brace?
No, I never had a brace. Never. This arm,
left arm,
was about like that. They said it never straightened out. I used to in our ward, hospital ward, I'd tie a rope on there and a pulley, and I kept pulling on that thing, and then I'd sweep the ward.
Your own physical therapy program, yeah. You designed for yourself?
Yeah. Well, I think I probably had a little coaching on the side.
A little cowboy logic?
but my whole left side was pretty well paralyzed. And I couldn't, for several years, I couldn't squeeze a tube of toothpaste even.
How did you get that strength back? Just push yourself?
Just by living with it.
What does the doctor say? Miracle?
No.
Well, he used to
never
tie
ask anybody.
He had him tie a broom on his arm and sweep the floors with that, which would kind of force it back.
I think I got that arm as straight as anybody else.
Yeah. I can't tell the difference.
I would never have known. When you talked about the wound, I would never have known that you were
wounded. For years, well, even now, I can't tell in the reach of my pocket. I can't tell a nickel from a quarter.
Because you don't have the sensation.
Don't have the sensitivity in this hand. I can in this hand, but I can't in this hand.
So
it's never affected me. This left arm of mine was never any good anyway. I was so terribly right-handed all my life that this just kind of hangs there.
And when you run,
so I was lucky again.
A lot of luck.
And it didn't happen to this.
Yeah. Somebody's watching out for you.
Yeah.
So when you were discharged, when was that?
I couldn't get discharged from the Army till I came back to the States in April, about the middle of April, and I wasn't discharged from the Army till the 4th of January. 4th of December, 45, yeah. It was, what, 8 months, something like that. I was in the hospital altogether 10 months.
And after you were discharged, then what did you do?
Got married. Okay. Well, I met my wife.
Did you know Nancy before you went
no,
to work?
Uh-uh.
And so
no,
how did you meet Nancy?
We met, my mother was living in an apartment in North Hollywood, and I'd go down to visit her on weekends, and and Nancy's sister and her husband owned this apartment house that my mother was living in, and Nancy had come out because she had rheumatic fever all of her life. They had a rheumatic fever hospital. The Army had a rheumatic fever hospital, or one that specialized in rheumatic fever cases. And so they sent her back out to California with drier and cleaner air than she was getting in Moline, Illinois. And that hospital, and it did her a lot of good.
It wasn't in the Army, but it was a case that the Army had a hospital there for that specific problem, and And so my doctor figured that, you know, that was a good recommendation, was to climb it out there, because I knew what it did to me at home, so.
So you both happened to be in the same place at the same time for separate medical reasons.
So did you meet in the hospital?
No.
You met at the...
Well,
you met at the...
Here again, I was real lucky. They'd, my left side had not recuperated sufficiently enough that they would discharge me. And that was the only thing that was holding up on my discharge, was that I just hadn't recuperated enough to where they felt like they could turn me loose, discharge me. And finally when they did, and the hospitals were full, of course, and there was lots of people coming back trying to get out of the Army, coming back through the hospitals. But they'd give me maybe a week, why don't you take a week off? You can have military leave for a week, and or maybe a weekend, and call back, and if you're all right, why, maybe we'll give you another week. Or so I was for a month or two, I was actually on leave, and I'd go down and stay with my mother. My brother Hal had come back. Yeah, he'd come back from the Pacific in the meantime, and he was stationed out there at Midderfield with the Air Corps, and we'd meet on weekends. But he was, and excuse me, and Nancy had a girlfriend of hers had an apartment across the hall from my mother. And my mother didn't think that my brother Hal and I were getting, she thought we were shell-shocked or something.
She wanted to reintroduce you to society?
Yeah, she wanted to, thought we didn't ought to get with it. And so she asked the girls to take us under our wing, and so they did.
Oh, so what a nice story.
Your mother introduced you to me.
Well, that's a nice story. Those mothers, they always watch out for you.
Yeah. Well, I think...